Thank you for having me. You know, listening to everybody talk about where you want to go, I feel I'm torn. I lived for many years in Israel, and I love it there. But on the other hand, I sure like to just go to Hawaii for a week. You know, I like the cleansing part too. Throw that in, a week of cleansing and doing that. My cousin told me Hawaii is the greatest place in the world to do nothing. And I'm running around so much, just a week of doing nothing kind of appeals to me a little bit. But it's also not just that. I think there's a sense of appreciation I hear in a lot of people for the beauty of the world and wanting to be in touch with that. And Maimonides actually says that one way towards great, refined, sublime spirituality is through nature, through appreciating nature. So it's really appropriate, you know, introduction to tonight's topic about spirituality. I asked one couple who came in, what attracted to you about this evening? Was it something in the topic, or was it just generally, you know, being with Rabbi Gelber and Rabbi Zin Gelber, or was it the company? Anyone want to tell me what you're hoping to get out of this tonight? This is just an open question.
That there's another aspect to life other than work and home. That there's another element that's missing.
You mean you feel like there is, but you're not in touch with that, and
exactly.
You'd like to get in touch with it?
Exactly.
I hear that. Anybody else?
I came to be with Rabbi Gelber. I think it's nice to stimulate your brain sometimes and get another objective on things and maybe get yourself thinking about things that you wouldn't necessarily think about.
Right, right. You know, yeah, go ahead.
Let's interrupt. I've been going on and off, and I'm trying to get more often to go to temple over day's climb. So I'd like to try to find out how to get a little more continuity, and instead of having these periods where I get involved, work and life gets so stressful, and
right.
Kind of get fall into a mode of dealing with that, and then you go back again, and just trying to find a common.
I think my theory is the root of that lack of consistency. Is that there's a, if I interviewed each one of you individually or took a poll, I think I'd get a dozen different definitions of spiritual or spirituality. Right? There's a lot of confusion, but what is this we're looking for? What exactly is it? You know, it's a word that's thrown out there too much. And what I'd like you to walk out of here tonight is, first of all, real clarity on a Jewish definition of what we're trying to do in the synagogue or outside the synagogue. Right? Number two, maybe some practical tool, one or two practical tools of how to capture that in your own life. How does that sound? So, to give you an introduction, this is a spirituality class. I should just say a little bit about myself. Before I was a rabbi, I was many other things. I wore other hats. And spiritually speaking, I came from a very mainstream reform upbringing, where after bar mitzvah, I basically walked away. Not because I had antagonism towards it, because there wasn't anything pulling me towards the synagogue anymore. But I was interested in something. Something in me told me there's more to life, and I was experimenting for a number of years. I tried lots of isms. Oh, good evening. Perfect timing.
This is Ryan and Anissa Phelps.
Sorry, really.
We just started. You're right on time. And so that, ladies and gentlemen, is the secret to life, the universe, and everything.
Thanks so much.
I just had one question that looks like that was a life.
But my son saw, right? Yeah, no, I know that. I met you a couple years ago.
Tell us your names again.
Ryan Phelps and Anissa Phelps.
Anissa Phelps. It was at a breakout session in Yom Kippur, maybe 2 years ago. Do you remember?
I do.
So we just got started, Brian, and I was saying that just in terms of my own background, you should know that I tried out a lot of isms. I tried out Buddhism. I tried out Hinduism. I tried out Christianity. I tried out nihilism. I tried out communism. And probably the one ism that, before I returned to Judaism, that spoke to me the most is probably Buddhism. And I can give you an hour-long, very humorous talk about that path, but what I found was, when I got into the yeshiva, I started really studying Judaism in the old text, is, hey, this is something deep here. This is something very powerful that they never taught me in Sunday school. And that's where I want to start from that. I'd like to ask you, to everybody get, first of all, into a meditative position. See if anybody knows what I'm talking about. Most people know this instinctively. You need to sit up straight, right? Shoulders relaxed. Come on, everybody. Feet on the ground. Now, this is a basic meditative position. You're sitting upright, relaxed, okay? And of course, like any good spirituality class, I'd like to ask you to close your eyes. And I'm going to teach you how to get into what the scientists call an alpha state, which is very easy. And once I teach this to you, you can do it any time of the day you'd like, wherever you happen to be sitting. With your eyes closed, go ahead, pick your right foot off the ground, and just twist the ankle around 3 times. 1, 2, 3, and put it down. Now you're up, your other foot, pick it up 3 times. 1, 2, 3, put it down. Now with your right hand, make a fist nice and tight. Hold it. 2, 3, and relax. Left hand, make a fist. Hold it. 2, 3, relax. Check your right shoulder. Let's rotate it 3 times. 1, 2, 3. There's a little crowd on the couch, I know. The other shoulder. 1, 2, 3. And now last, let's do our heads to the side. All the way down to the shoulder. Not so it hurts, just so it stops, and hold it. Now back up, and now down to the other side. And hold it. 2, 3. And keep the eyes closed. Let's now put the heads back up. With your eyes closed, you're now in what's called an alpha state, a state of relaxation, where you are able to get into, use meditative devices to go wherever you want to go. With your mind's eye, I'd like you to picture in your mind, try to remember the most beautiful sunset you ever saw. Remember where you were. Maybe you were on top of a mountain. Maybe you were on a beach. If you'd like, you can choose a sunrise. Remember that. The scene and who was with you and how the air felt and how the sky was changing colors from reds to oranges to yellows to blues to violets. Gorgeous. You're speechless. If you could say anything at all, it would simply be, wow. You can open your eyes. Now, what is that sense of wow? That sense of wonder that we have once in a while, maybe once a year, whenever we happen to make it to Florida with our scuba gear? Judaism has tools that teaches us how to capture that kind of transcendental wow every day. Throughout the day, whenever you want. That's what I call the book, Art of Amazement. The ability to tap into that is in my understanding of Judaism, Judaism 101. And I'd like to give you just the first step towards that tonight. How's that sound? Okay? So this is meant to be a dialogue. So I'm going to throw out questions, but I expect you to ask questions too. You interrupt me anytime if something doesn't make sense. A little bit of history, and I'm going to go a little quickly because normally this is a hour and a half talk I like to give as an introduction. I was told I have about 30, 45 minutes. So I'd like just to give you just a bit of a background so that you have some, what my college professors call a cocktail party insurance. You know, next time you have a cocktail party and someone asks you a question about Jewish history, you should have something to say. So when does Judaism start? With what person?
Abraham.
Who? Abraham. Okay, let's take Abraham. What's he called in Hebrew?
Abraham.
Anyone can give me a ballpark date for Abraham?
2000
BC. 2000 BC, I have one vote. Any other votes? Okay, you're pretty close. I'm going to give you a slightly different date, but and these are not precise, but you'll see why this is helpful. I'm going to give you 1700 BCE. Okay? That's a ballpark date. Why? Because it makes it easy to remember everything after that. 400 years after that, we have this person named Moses, about 1300. You know, the Ten Commandments, the whole thing, you see the movie? Yeah? Okay. Now, after Moses, the next jump is 400 years after that, we have King Solomon, who builds the first temple. Anyone want to take a guess how long the first temple stood, roughly?
40 years.
How much?
40 years.
Sorry, look at the chart here. Ah, there you go. About 400 years. Wait, see the pattern here? So the first temple, the destruction by the Babylonians was about, and this is again, these are ballpark dates just to give you that cocktail party insurance. Okay? Now, that was the first temple period right here, and then we had a little bit of a break, and how long did the second temple stand?
70.
About 400 years. Okay, it was a little bit more, but I'm just giving you the ballpark, okay? What I want to point out to you is something really interesting, that there's some interesting information in the Midrash about what was actually happening during this time that we don't see in the text of Tanakh, of the Torah. What's the Midrash? Anyone heard this word before? Midrash. Sorry?
It's a book. It's a chapter or something.
It is a set of books.
Interpretation.
The word actually means stories. And it's really misunderstood. It is interpretations, but it's more than that. And the best way I can explain it to you is like this. You ever heard of Cliff's Notes?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you never used them, but maybe you had a roommate once who did. You know, if,
I use them. I won't be shy.
Okay. You know, if you have a test tomorrow on Middle March, you can't be bothered to read it, right? So read the Cliff's Notes.
Well, I would read both.
Okay.
Because I have a...
Okay, you were obviously very studious and a very good student. Okay. Most of us would just read the Cliff's Notes, okay? Well, the analogy is like this. The Torah, the five books of Moses, that's the Cliff's Notes. You want the full story? You read the Midrash. For example, Abraham appears in the Torah at what age? How old is he when you first see him? 75. What happened the first 74 years of his life? Doesn't say a thing in the Torah about it. It's in the Midrash. All kinds of stories about his childhood. Another example. What was Abraham's father's name?
Terah.
Okay. What was his mother's name? Not mentioned in the Torah. Maybe he didn't have a mother. That's a different religion where they have one parent, not another, right? We believe people have two parents. So you look in the Midrash, it says his mother's name, Amasalai. So, and so on and so forth. The Midrash is full of details about the lives of people that are not in the Cliff's Notes, meaning the five books of Moses. So it says in the Midrash something really fascinating, that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob all studied in this, some kind of school in the Middle East, set up by Noah's son, Shem. Remember Noah had three sons on the ark? One of them set up the school, and they all studied there. Well, what do you think they studied there? They studied astronomy. They studied astrology. And some kind of spiritual arts that we're not sure exactly what they were. Meditative arts. It also says in the Midrash something very interesting that very few rabbis know. During this time period, Solomon's time down to the destruction, some people have been to Israel. I heard some people say they've been to Israel. Has anyone else been to Israel? The land of Israel was full of, for want of a better term in English, we'll call them meditation schools. It's kind of hard for us to relate to. Where many, many, many Israelites, Jews, were practicing some kind of meditative art, learning the ropes. And each one was run by what's called a prophet, a certified prophet, who's reached a certain level of meditation. This is really hard for us to relate to, because Judaism doesn't look like this at all anymore. And what happened? So it's a long history. I'm just trying to give you a taste of how we've really lost touch in some ways with something essential to Judaism. But it's coming back, and books like mine, there's other books that are attempting to teach how to really tap into that essence of Judaism, even through the traditional practices you have. Okay? Any comments or questions before I raise? Taking notes? Okay, remember the 400 years. Okay. Now, I'm going to just go now into the actual philosophy, and this is where it really gets difficult. And it all starts, to really understand everything Jewish and spiritual, it all starts with this guy named, this Jewish guy named Al Einstein. Okay? Now, here's the story. Judaism actually agrees with modern science that the universe that we live in had a beginning. Now, I'm sure you've heard this before, right? Where does it say this in Judaism?
Genesis.
First line of Genesis. What does it say? In the beginning, right? It said that for thousands of years. Do you know the story of how modern science came upon the idea of a Big Bang? You ever heard this before? What was Einstein famous for?
Theory of relativity.
Which is?
Equals MC squared.
E equals MC squared. That's what's called special relativity. Right? Then this was 1905 when he published this. For the next 10 years, Einstein worked on what's called general relativity, a theory of gravity. And in 1915, he basically finished the work. He started circulating his equations to his fellow scientists in Europe. And one of them, a Russian mathematician, pointed out a major problem in Einstein's equations. He said, you know, Al, you got a problem here. According to your equations, the universe should be getting bigger, expanding. Einstein went to astronomers he knew and asked them, do you have any evidence the universe is expanding? They said, sorry, Al, you got it wrong this time. So he fudged the equations. He actually tweaked them so that it would come out a static universe, not expanding. Well, guess what happened? We all know the story. 1929, Edwin Hubble, over in California, the world's largest telescope, comes up with conclusive proof the universe is expanding, called redshift. Einstein was so troubled by this that this was in December of 29. In January, February 1930, he was already on a boat headed over from Berlin over to California to check out the telescope and the photographs himself. And Newsweek reported that on the spot, to his greatness as a scientist, right, he admitted he had been wrong, that Hubble was right. And later he called the fudging equations the greatest mistake of my life. Think about that. Einstein saying that. He could have predicted by over a decade expanding universe mathematically, and he failed to. Because of what? This is my big question for you. What was bothering Einstein back in 1915, 1917 so much that he fudged the equation? What was bothering him about the mathematical evidence? I've read a couple biographies of Einstein. I can't find the answer. What was it? Is it because it's so radical a theory that he just couldn't deal with it? Wait a second. You don't get more radical than this, that energy and matter are equivalent. It could be that it was so radical. I have to conclude the thought. This is my own hypothesis. I have my own conclusion. I think what was bothering Einstein wasn't Einstein the scientist, it was Einstein the Jew. Because if you think about it, if you're a thinking person, you have to ask yourself the following question. If the universe had a beginning, you have to ask yourself, if the universe had a beginning, what came before that? Think about it. Think about Einstein's problem. If the universe is getting bigger, that means yesterday it was, and the day before that it was, that implies that it had a beginning. If it had a beginning, though, what came before that? Science can't go there. Science can only deal with what we can measure or observe. By definition, science stops at the beginning. The premier journal of science is called what? Nature. Nature. Science is about nature. What exists? Matter, space, time. What happened to the Big Bang, according to all scientists who studied the Big Bang? What began? Space. Matter.
Time.
And time. It's a meaningless question to say before the time. What kind of question is that for a scientist? You hear that? So what do we do? Just leave it as unknown? Well, where science doesn't go, Judaism does. Jewish philosophy says, no, we can go before the Big Bang. We can talk about it. Before the Big Bang, there was something. Before space, matter, and time, there was something. What was that? You talking about God? Can we leave God out of this place? I say that tongue-in-cheek, but do you know why I say that? It's a problem. You know the biggest stumbling block to Jewish spirituality is in all of history? It's not the destruction of the temple. What's the biggest stumbling block to Jewish spirituality in all of history? A guy named Michelangelo. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you know what I'm talking about, Michelangelo, the Sistine Chapel? He gave us literally a cartoon image of God, right? Whenever people throw in God, I always think, what are they talking about? Are they talking about this? Here's God in American culture, right? An old man with a white beard. This is saying he's playing with the devil. It says God didn't play dice with you. He was a big fan of Pictionary, and he's saying, "No, you idiot, it's Mother Teresa." Okay, this is funny, but where's this image come from? I think this is Michelangelo's cartoon that's been refined, right? So whenever someone talks about God, I say that tongue in cheek, but it worries me because I think many people immediately think of this. Now, I don't think this is what you think, but that's why I say that. You know, it's okay. It's a very religious answer. I'm not interested in that right now, actually. No offense. Okay? But I like to take a philosophical answer. Maybe we can go there. What do these things have in common? Well, one might argue, and philosophers say, that what they have in common is they're all finite. They all have a beginning. They all can be measured. They're all, by definition, finite. Therefore, what came before all this was what, by definition? Must have been something not finite or infinite, infinite. Now this is a problem. We're at a big problem right here. And know this. Because our brains are finite. And for a finite brain to grasp some infinite concept, the mystics say, it's like, try to reach with your hand and grab my words as they come out of my mouth. You can't do that. Yet we have to do that, and we try to dance around this and get closer, and you'll see the process of analyzing this term of infinite and try to understand it. We'll get really, really close to understanding spirituality. Okay? Now, I'm going to go through this a little quickly. So if I lose you or go too fast, someone stop me. Because we all want to get to the meat of the talk, which is the practical. And this is just the background. So when we say infinite, what we mean is what? What does infinite mean?
Something without boundaries.
No boundaries, right? Literally no limits. No limits. No lacking. Goes on forever. Remember the number line in high school, right? Well, it's actually not just a number line. It means, in Jewish philosophy, it means unlimited in every possible way. Infinitely in space. Infinitely in time. Infinitely in everything. The sum of all possibilities. Okay? So what? So what? Well, listen carefully. What we're trying to do right now is define. What does define mean? What does it mean literally? To give it
limits.
Limit. How can you define something that's infinite? Now listen to my words very carefully. This infinite lacks nothing, right? No lack, no infinite limit, except for one thing. What is the one thing that the infinite, whatever it is, philosophically, just be a philosopher, okay? Whether or not this is true or not, just philosophically speaking, by definition, what's the one thing that something infinite lacks?
Limits.
Right? It has no limits, no lacking. I wrote it on the board. I wasn't trying to be a trick question. You hear this. By definition, something infinite lacks exactly one thing. Limit. Do you hear that? Now, hold that idea for one second. I'm going to say the same thing in different words. You'll see how it works. If I were to make a list of all these space, matter, time, all these qualities of infinite, whatever that means, there's one word I'm going to put on the board on my list, philosophically speaking, all these ways we look at the infinite, that does not work. An infinite can be infinitely in space, infinitely all matter, all time, but there's one thing an infinite cannot be. Okay, what is that? I'm going to put it over here. I'm going to put this in quotes, because it's a human term. What is philosophically the problem with that? Can you read that? When infinite being infinitely giving, what is philosophically problematic about that? Put yourself in the infinite's shoes for a second, okay? You're the infinite, okay? What's wrong with this? Why can't you do this?
It's a loop.
What do you mean? It
just keeps going.
What do you mean?
It's repetitive.
You can never give enough.
No end to it.
So? That doesn't bother me. No, that's actually impossible. Not that it's a loop doesn't bother me. If it was a loop, that'd be fine. It's even worse than that. It doesn't even start. Why not?
There's nothing to give.
Why not?
No,
you're infinite. You have everything there is. What was that second thing
no
you said?
There's
what was that second thing you said?
There's no one to receive.
I mean, giving implies what? From me to... If you're the infinite, there's no one else. You can't give. Do you hear what I'm saying?
Right.
By definition, giving doesn't get started. So this, what we see from our scientific lens, a Big Bang, the mystics say from the infinite's perspective, as it were, they call it tzimtzum in Hebrew, a contraction or a hiding. It actually covers part of his infiniteness. It creates a lack where there was no lack in order to fill the lack. Do you hear that? Did you hear me? I just told you the most important secret you'll ever hear your entire life. I just told you the purpose of every single molecule in this universe, including yourselves and myself, which are the most complex arrangement of molecules. And what's that purpose? This is the giving. The filling the lack is the giving. So what is our purpose? We are the lack to receive. Do you hear that? We're the recipients. Do you hear this? That is what Judaism says is the purpose. This was Abraham's great insight. You know, if you heard, what was Abraham? He was the first what? You heard this before. When you were in Sunday school, what did they tell you? Abraham was the first?
Monotheist.
That's actually a lie. You know that, right? Look in the Torah. What about Noah?
Right.
What about Adam? He wasn't the first monotheist. What did he do that was revolutionary? What he did in a polytheistic society, he came up with not only the monotheistic principle, which Aristotle did too, by the way, the unmoved mover, but Abraham took it a step further. Abraham said like this, wait a second, look at this beautiful world. There's the sky and the trees and the flowers, the people, so beautiful, where's it all come from? Maybe it's like the Babylonian state, it comes from the sun. But wait a second, then he saw the sun sets and the moon rises, maybe the moon's more powerful. And then he sees the cloud go over the moon, maybe the cloud's more powerful. Wait a second. Anything that's limited obviously comes from somewhere. It must be something unlimited that got it all started somewhere. That was Abraham's insight. So what? He took it the next step. He said, wait a second, if what started all this is something unlimited, with no lacking, then it could not have created all this for itself. It doesn't need anything. So why did it create? Create it for me, said Abraham. For my pleasure. And I want that pleasure, he said. And he figured out how to get it. And he taught it to his children. And it comes down to us in a system known as Judaism. That's really what Judaism is. the system for teaching us how to maximize our pleasures in life. That's what it is. Now, I know what you're thinking, because I heard all your introductory remarks. When I say pleasure, you're thinking Florida, Israel, for me, Hawaii, right? On the beach, I don't know, but underwater, I'd be on the beach, maybe with my favorite drink in each hand, right? That is definitely a type of pleasure. But what Judaism is teaching us is not just about physical pleasures, but about pleasures that are of all types. Emotional, intellectual, spiritual pleasure, all kinds of pleasures are all brought down in Torah and wisdom about how to maximize our pleasure in this world. How's that? Sound pretty good? Now, questions? About the philosophy, because we're going to move on. You have to get this. So now, here's where it comes really interesting. And I'm going to ask you a question. So usually somebody asks this question at the beginning of the discussion, this is a good time to ask. Raise your hand if you believe that you have a soul. This is very important to know. I got you, it's a trick question. You don't have a soul. You are a soul. You have a body. But you've been so programmed by your society to think of yourself as a body. You know, the society is always saying, you're a body, you're a body, you're a body. All the advertisements say you're a body, right? Constantly, that's all you see, right? That's not you. The real you, the essential you that exists before your life, that will exist after your death, is soul. That's fused to body. And yes, you're a combination of two right now. But to understand this is key to understanding everything. Because every one of these types of experiences I mentioned that Judaism teaches is about, physical, emotional, intellectual, all have two sides to the coin, the body and the soul. What I'd like to do is this. This is actually, I'm giving you a very advanced class right now. What'd you say?
It's a snail.
Okay. Oh, let me do this one. How's that? That's all you need to know. Okay? We'll just make a photocopy of this for everybody. In a nutshell, what this model does, I created this to try to illustrate, I think, what's just the correct way of understanding all of life. The whole life is captured in this chart here. The A stands for aesthetic. Aesthetic pleasures. What are examples of aesthetic pleasures?
Sight.
Things you, a beautiful painting. Beautiful fish under the ocean. What else?
Music, sound.
Wonderful music.
Smell.
Beautiful smells.
Taste.
Gourmet food. What else? Come on, your favorite aesthetic experience.
Touch.
Sorry?
Touch.
Touch. Ah, something warm and fuzzy. Okay? No, a favorite aesthetic. This side of the room is very quiet over here. I've got you dumbfounded or stupefied. What is it? Your favorite sensory experience?
Eating sushi.
Ah, eating sushi. Now,
I think he's looking for sex.
Now, recognize that eating sushi or your favorite aroma or your favorite sight or sound, any one of those pleasures has two sides to it. It has the side of the gourmet. What's a gourmet? Someone who savors the pleasure, who really is sensitive, right? You know, believe it or not, you know there's some people. Can, I don't know if there's somebody in this room. I'm glad you're sitting down because I'm going to tell you something rather shocking. There's some people who cannot tell the difference between a $50 bottle of wine and a $5 bottle of wine. Do you know that?
Mm-hmm.
What does it take to tell the difference? Besides $45, what's the difference? What's that?
An expert.
Takes education.
Experience.
And what else? If someone is an expert and they're a gourmet wine drinker, are they guaranteed to appreciate that $50 bottle of wine every time they drink it? What else does it take? at the moment they're drinking it?
Attention.
Paying attention, right? Appreciating it. They could guzzle it down just like anybody else. You need both. You hear that? So therefore, that experience has the potential either to be what I call a soul experience, meaning the aesthetic, the gourmet, or a body experience, the what the French call gourmand, a gluttonous experience, just feeding your stomach. And every, if you think about it, every physical experience you have has that potential. Give me an example of physical experience that does not have that potential. To either be a gourmet experience, where you're going to savor it, or just a consuming, feeding your body experience. Whether you're eating, or you're smelling, or you're touching, or you're seeing, or hearing, any experience, physical experience has that potential. You hear that? So there, and what happens is that you have this tension throughout your life, your body versus your soul, and your body keeps saying, just feed me. And your soul says, no, no, save your food. Now, this ever happened to you? This is, I'm going to go to the next level. This F, what does L stand for? Anyone guess? What's a higher level than aesthetic that you would give up all your aesthetic experience for if you had to, for the sake of?
Love.
Your love, right? Your loved ones, people you care about, right? Now, this is the same idea. We have the same tension between what my body wants to do and my soul wants to do. You know, beautiful woman walks by, my body says, hey, I'm in love, right? That's not love when my body says that. What is that?
Love.
That's lust, infatuation. You know, maybe she's a terrible person when I get to know her, right? Real love only comes when I get to know somebody, okay? And that's a whole class in itself on how each one of these, by the way, is a separate, you know, our discussion, what Judaism teaches, and how to cultivate it, and how to maximize the spiritual side of it rather than the physical. But, you know, you don't have to be religious or Jewish, obviously, to savor good food. What's so Jewish about this? You know what's Jewish about it? That's this.
Togetherness.
Transcendental. Remember the sunset? What happens is when you eat a beautiful, you think of your favorite sushi, or your favorite aroma, or your favorite whatever that you enjoy, physically speaking, right? You savor it, but if you also appreciate what a gift this is, that you're in this position to be able to enjoy this, and that you have eyes and ears to appreciate it with, and taste buds, that this is really ultimately a gift from the creator of the world, the one who invented the whole world and put you here to enjoy it, then that experience simultaneously becomes transcendental. And your physical aesthetic experiences can zoom up there. Your love experiences with your loved ones, when you appreciate, wow, this person's a gift in my life. To have this person in my life, zoom, you're right there. What's E?
Elation.
What'd you say?
Elation.
So what's something that you... Oh, this is what gets scary. I would give up my aesthetic for my loved ones. What's something you would give up your loved ones for, God forbid? What's something that everyone would give up their loved ones for, everyone in this room? It's kind of scary to hear that, isn't it?
Eternity.
Ethical. For doing the right thing. If it was the question of right or wrong. Now, this is why people send their kids off to war, or their husbands or wives off to war, or they go off to war themselves. Why do they do that? Because they believe it's the right thing to do. Everyone in this room would do it under certain circumstances. If it's not this war, it's a different war. If it's not that war, if you're a pacifist, I'll find some situation where if the choice is your loved ones are doing the right thing, you would not do the wrong thing. You'd rather be good than evil, even more than saving your loved ones. That's the truth about everybody. So that's kind of scary, but that's just being aware of it is very, very energizing. And that, because that's a very powerful urge. You know what an example of this is, of the struggle from the body and the soul? Is the executive and the secretary. It's my favorite story, is the executive and the secretary. The executive just made a mistake that's going to cost the company about $1 million. But fortunately, there's only one person knows about it, the secretary. So the executive can do what? Either fire the secretary, and say, look, my word against hers, you know, who are they going to believe? Or do what? What's the choice? I can either fire the secretary, blame it on her, or do what?
Own up to it.
Own up to it, to tell the truth, right? What would motivate me to fire the secretary? Because why would I not want to tell the truth?
Ego.
What about the ego?
He needs to maintain his ego, because he feels like he can't admit he's wrong.
Why not? Why can't he admit he's wrong?
Well, the asset factors, maybe.
What?
The asset factor is the way people would look at him.
Exactly. Because he's more afraid about looking good than being good. That's called confusion. What wants to look good, your body or your soul? Your body. Your soul wants to be good. And we've all heard these stories of someone who, after many years, admits they were the one who did such and such, and was such a, even though they went to jail, it was such a relief to finally own up to it. It really is a powerful, powerful drive to be good. Nobody, very few people want to say, I'm really evil. People don't do that. We rationalize, we justify. Well, you know, it's not going to cost the company that much money, they won't notice it anyway. How many times a day do we rationalize? How many times a day do we do it with our spouses? You know? Yeah, you know, she wasn't being nice to me anyway. Right? You know what the hardest phrase in the English language to say? Even harder than I'm sorry.
I'm wrong.
I was wrong. This is a tremendous exercise. My challenge for you tonight, sometimes I spend the whole night talking about just the A, and then I realize, you know, I can give you a good A tool, but then I don't see you again, like, for years. So instead, I'm giving you, like, the whole picture tonight, and if you want the A, you can get one of my tapes, you read the book, or you have another class, but I want to give you an E exercise. Here's your E exercise. I'm going to give you this as a challenge you go home tonight. Lock yourself in the bathroom, look in the mirror, and practice saying, I was wrong. I'm sorry. I blew it. I goofed. I'm really sorry. Practice it till you're really, really good at it. You will find it will change every single relationship in your life. Your spouse, at work, your kids if you have them, your parents, cousins. Being a genius at saying, I'm wrong, I'm sorry, is the key to true greatness. And the true true happiness. But when you do it, next time you're in that situation where you're faced with your own faults, or you're faced with a dilemma, do I fire the secretary? Or do I own up to my mistake? Recognize also that you were given that moment to make you into a great person. You're given that challenge to make you into a great person. You know, we all have this struggle. It's a daily struggle. It's such a daily struggle that it's actually the very first line of the book we have in Judaism called the Shulchan Aruch. You heard of this book before? That is sometimes translated as the Code of Jewish Law. This is the book that's supposed to outline Jewish daily living. How to do Shabbat. How to do holidays. You know, how to give tzedakah. All the details of Jewish daily living. The very first line in this whole book that sets the tone for the entire corpus of Judaism says what? A person should get out of bed in the morning like a lion. Have you ever seen those nature films about lions? How do lions get out of bed in the morning?
They yawn.
They roll over. Is that what the Shulchan Aruch is talking about? Obviously not. What is it obviously talking about? Getting out of bed like a lion attacks, right? This ever happened to you? The alarm goes off, right? This happened to me this morning. The alarm goes off and you think, your body says, how about 10 more minutes? Right? And your soul says, no, you got to get up now. You can change the world. And your body says, come on. You can change the world 10 minutes. It's a big deal, right? So you hit the snooze button. Pretty soon, what's happened? It's been half an hour, right? Don't tell me this never happened to you, right? Another example, you're walking through the kitchen, right? And you feel like there's something calling you. I know it's those cookies over there, right? I'm just going to have a half a cookie, but you're on a diet. Your body says, of course we're on a diet, but what's a half a cookie? Your soul says, yeah, I guess you're right, right? Pretty soon what? You're eating about 5 or 6 cookies, right? Or 10, right? There's only, in both these situations, there's only one solution. What's the solution? To leap like a lion. What does that mean? As soon as that voice, and that voice isn't the cookies, by the way. What is that voice? It's your body. It's your body. As soon as that body starts talking, what do you have to do? Leap away. Run away. Don't listen. The second you start getting in that dialogue, you're gone. And this comes down in the story of Adam and Eve, by the way. The snake is actually a symbol of the body calling to her. And her big mistake was what, based on what I just told you? Getting in the conversation. As soon as the snake said, psst, Eve, come here, she should have just kept on walking, right? As soon as she started talking to the snake, she's a goner. The snake tricked her. She had a real good excuse. It's true, the snake tricks her, but her mistake was getting the conversation started with. How are we doing time? They're not asleep yet. Oh, perfect. So, I've given you... Okay. My homework for you is this. What I'd like you to do is this. One of the most powerful things you can do in this vein is keep up for 1 week, keep a little journal. just before you go to bed in a little notebook, write down approximately five challenges you've had, body, soul challenges that day, today. Maybe it was with food, maybe it was with a loved one, maybe it was admitting you're right or wrong. Write them down and put a star next to the ones where you succeeded. And by doing this every day for a week, what you'll find is you become more aware of them at the time when they're actually happening. And instead of letting your body control your life and guide you, let the soul be in charge. As the rabbis say, it's like a rider on a horse. Are you going to let the horse decide where to go? Or is the rider going to decide where to go? Too often we let our horse go wherever it wants to go, and the soul part of us, which is the rider, should be in control, is not in control. You can take control. It's not easy. It's a struggle. It's like trying to get off the couch and do some exercise. It's so hard. You know, your soul says, come on, let's get some exercise. The body says, not today. I can't do it. And then you have to trick your body into it. Now you do it. You say, you have to use against the body its own desire. Say, but think how good you look and how good you feel. And the body's like, yeah, that's true. I want to look good. I want to feel good. So then you get your body off and just go for a walk, right? And the next day it's a little bit easier, right? Next day a little bit easier. If you can really do that for about 2 weeks, what happens when you miss a day? Your body's like, hey, where's my exercise? The body is totally trainable. And if you become a genius at savoring your food, if you become a genius at focusing on the person's essence and not on their physicality, if you become a genius at admitting you're wrong after you get good at it, it's really hard not to do it. But it takes work and training. So you can either buy the bestseller, to be, and read my exercises, or you can take more classes with Rabbi Geller, Rabbi Porter, or you can listen online. But whatever you do, make sure you make it part of your discipline. When you go to shul, it's supposed to be a time to meditate on this. And actually the prayer book, you know what the prayer book is? It's simply a guide to all of this, if you really interpret it right, in my view. That's where all those prayers and blessings, they're really meditative moments, deepen your awareness of where you fit in this model. And that's, of course, more education. I'm going to wrap because it's 9, and some people maybe have to go home to babysitters or other things.
Yeah.
Oh, you've got to read the book. Okay, I'll tell you. I can stay for questions, but I want people who maybe have to go to know that they're free to get up and go, and they're not captive here. I'll stay as long as the captain's let me. The C. Notice I put a dotted line here. You see, this is a dashed line. I didn't put a solid line. The C is and E really are. They go together. This gets totally overwhelmed by this. You would give up all your physical pleasure for the sake of loved ones, would you not? Would you not spend any amount of money to save your loved ones? Of course you would. And you would, you may not like it, but you would actually give up your loved ones for the sake of doing the right thing if push came to shove. You know, God forbid, you shouldn't have to, but if it came that way, you theoretically would. But this doesn't happen. This is actually this part and parcel of the same thing. C is really an expansion of E. E is what?
Ethics.
E is doing the right thing. C is creativity. What's creativity? What's true creativity? Anyone here an artist? Or anyone here study art or enjoy art? Mm-hmm. A great art. What is great art for? What is the artist trying to do?
Express himself.
Yeah. Just express himself? Why hang it in a gallery?
He wants an audience.
He wants an audience. He wants to affect other people. All right? Creativity is applying your ethics to others. You know what a good example of this is? If you want to be at the E level, don't litter. Stay at home and don't litter. You're perfectly ethical in the area of littering, right? But to get to C, you have to go outside your house and figure out, how do I get other people to stop littering? You hear the difference? C is an expansion of E into other people's lives. You hear that? A really good example in the Torah is Noah. If you remember the story, if you haven't read it in a long time, you enjoy this. Read the story of Noah. God says to Noah, build an ark. What does Noah do? He builds an ark. God says, go in the ark. Noah goes in the ark. God says, go out of the ark. Goes out of the ark. Right? Whatever he's told to do, he does. Right? That's fine. That's Noah. And he's called righteous in his generation. He's perfectly righteous vis-a-vis his own generation. Abraham, on the other hand, is told, similar to Noah, I'm going to kill all these people. What does Abraham do? Instead of saying, okay, he says, wait a second, God, can we talk about this? Maybe there's some righteous people there. He tries to get involved in other people's lives. That's the difference. This is like a Noah, and this is like an Abraham and Sarah, right? They open up their home. You know, Abraham and Sarah, when they realized that the principle of understanding the divine, the transcendent, right? The infinite, the God, the Hashem, if you want. When they understood that God's basic essence was giving, relationship to us, they said, how can we be most godlike? Let's become the world's greatest givers. And they opened up their house in the corner of a crossroads, and anyone who came, they invited them in for a meal. That's what were they doing that for? Because they wanted to be godlike, being givers. And if you want to really be walking the footsteps of Abraham and Sarah, you have to be generous, you have to be giving, you have to be compassionate. But that's not the end of the story. That's the start of the story. That's the start of Jewish history. There's many, many details after that. I can stay as long as you like. This is, you know, I'm giving you a nutshell taste of Jewish spirituality. I said at the beginning, I'd like you to walk away with a definition of spirituality. Does anybody have, feel like you have that now? Mm-hmm. Can someone define spirituality now? What is spirituality? Maybe I should summarize. What is spirituality? Mm-hmm. Spirituality is beliefs or actions or things you do that are nurturing and for your soul. The aspect of you that is soul. As opposed to materialism, which is beliefs and actions, behaviors that are nurturing and feeding the body part of you. Do you hear that? That's what spirituality is. And you can be spiritual without being religious. You can be spiritual without being Jewish. And I oppose that to being transcendental. Being transcendental does not happen automatically. That you have to appreciate where this comes from. Appreciate who's calling you and who's trying to reach you and who's trying to communicate. Who's trying to communicate with you? You were put here for a purpose. You were put here for a reason. This life is not a bunch of random molecules and monkeys bumping into each other and producing human beings. It may be monkeys bumping into each other, but it's not random. Judaism says we're all here for a purpose, and that is to find our relationship in this model. The question is what you're going to do with it. Are you going to take this wisdom and go home and try to find that relationship and become a true Yehudi, which means what? What does the word Yehudi mean? What's the etymology of Yehudi? Means being thankful. Yeah. Lahodot. To give thanks. This is what it means to be a Jew. Not just thankful in general, but thankful to the one who put you here. Thanks for coming tonight.
Thank you very much.